And at one point in time, there was about 12,000 Volvos sitting in fields all across Canada.
Rotting.
They were just rotting. And they had no idea. Dealers weren't buying them. No one was buying them. And they were just sitting there going, well, we're selling cars. So ended up that a dealer principal I worked for, and I came to this idea that we were a dealership right on the border of the United States.
Welcome to the Sensei Playbook, the ultimate podcast for the automotive industry. Each week, we dive into the success stories and best practices from industry leaders who put customer experience first. From driving repeat business to earning coveted referrals, discover the tools and tactics that set the best apart. Get ready to hit the road to success. This is the Sensei Playbook.
So we're here today with Peter Smith. Thank you for joining us, Peter. Looking forward to the conversation. And why don't we just start off by you telling us a little bit about your background.
My name is Peter Smith. I'm the founder and managing partner of Lion Partnership. It's a strategic consulting service for the automobile industry. I'm located just outside Toronto in Canada, but 100% of my business is in the U.S. So basically my history in the car business is I love cars since I was a kid, like our most young boys do. When I was 14, I loved them so much, I started a car washing business. And I was reading car magazines, and they said this new thing called detailing. Detailing is where it's at. And you could charge more if you use Q-tips when you clean the car and things like that. 1982, at 14 years old, I was charging $100 to clean a car. And I had six customers every week lined up to get me to clean their cars, to bring them back to showroom condition. And it was a great, great opportunity. I was making money under the table and no taxes. And I actually probably made more than my dad at that point in time. I buy my first car at 16 and I have a Mustang. Fox body Mustang. What's every kid with a Fox body Mustang do? They crash it. And so I crashed my Mustang, totaled my body, and spent the next 5 years in hospital, off and on in hospital.
Cool.
Yeah, I've lived through it. It was just a perfect storm of everything that could happened, be it from where the accident happened, what hit me, how it hit me, the medical issues, everything. It was just a perfect storm for badness. And in that time period, I wasn't able to go to school, but I was also not able to work. And the only thing I could do was go to the car industry and be a valet driver or car washer or things like that, just to keep living basically. And I owe that to the car industry for keeping my sanity together. In doing so, I progressed to becoming a car salesman as I was going through all this. And at 19, I was ranked in the top 100 Toyota salespeople in Canada with all my issues. By the time I was 25, I was working in Europe for a Ford Motor Company, and I launched a new thing called business development in Europe. And it had never been done before. And instead of doing the phone calls that we think about BDCs over here, we actually walked from business to business asking for business. We'll call them.
Door knocking.
So we go to these industrial parks and we knock on doors and saying, who do you buy your cars off of? Who do you service your cars at? Well, we want your business, and I don't care if you're driving an Opel or you're driving a whatever, we want to service your cars. And so that was a unique situation. And then I got homesick, came back to Canada, started working in the premium business, and quickly elevated to top salesperson in my respective manufacturers. But Chris and I had a conversation that was quite unique. And that was in 1999, Volvo was owned by Ford. And Ford also owned Hertz at the time. So they mandated that Volvo put loaner car, or rental cars into the Hertz fleet.
Well, Volvo, being a small manufacturer, didn't know what they were doing. And they just kept on selling cars. They didn't realize that those cars were coming back. And at one point in time, there was about 12,000 Volvos sitting in fields all across Canada.
Rotting.
They were just rotting. And they had no idea. Dealers weren't buying them. No one was buying them. And they were just sitting there going, well, we're selling cars. So ended up that a dealer principal I worked for, and I came to this idea that we were a dealership right on the border of the United States, and the money at that time was about $1.45 Canadian for every U.S. dollar. And Volvos were actually assembled in Canada, so they skirted the duty issue. So we could sell them into the States with no duty, or very little duty, and with the money exchange, we could sell them retail ready for about $5,000 to $6,000 less than they could buy them at the auction. So wow. We started advertising. This was pre-internet era for dealerships. We started advertising in papers all over the United States that we had these cars. And so we started selling them privately, and I sold them in every single state in the union privately. And we were shipping them everywhere, and it was great business, but we had to run them through a importer. And as we ran them through importers, dealers started hearing that we were installing these cars.
Right.
And they were going, well, how do we buy them? And so I started getting clients, and everyone knows the alpha dog, Jim Ziegler. Well, Jim was one of my original clients, and I would sell him cars to his Volvo dealership. And then Tamkin Automotive and all kinds of other ones. And I ended up selling 3,500 of these rental units to dealers and public people all across the United States in 1 year. Where there wasn't technology in dealerships. The accounting department didn't have technology. No one had technology. We brought in folding picnic tables into the accounting office just to pack deal files on top of them. And we had these four or five of these 4x8 tables in the accounting office piled with, 2 feet high deal packets all over the place, to the point when I resigned my position at the dealership, it took them 7 months to pay out my commissions. It was a different world back then, but so then I progressed through the industry and did a number of different things and went in and out of the industry. It was like Godfather Part 4. Once you're out, you think you're out, then they pull you back in. Well, I got pulled back in November of 2022 because I bought a car. For the first time in probably 2 decades, I had to go buy a car. And I went out and I bought this car, and it was the worst buying experience I've ever had in my entire life. It was so bad that I had to write about it. And when I wrote about it, it was picked up by Automotive News and Canadian Dealer Magazine and things like that. And I started venting to them as they were interviewing me. And I said, I'm going to change this business. I'm going to invest every single cent I have to change how people are treated in this business. When I talk people treated, it's not only the customers, but the teams below the management and how they're treated by this business. I didn't want it to be the churn and burn business that it's always been. I didn't want it to be anything different than what we would expect in purchasing something worth tens of thousands of dollars. We get better service at a Chick-fil-A. We get better service at Red Roof Inn. We get better service at things that we would never, ever spare. As often said, the amount of money that goes into training someone on a Chick-fil-A versus what we put into training a person in the car business, when the average ticket is tens of thousands of times more, why is that? So I wanted to change it, and then that's how I started Lion Partnership. And the name Lion Partnership came up because I wanted to put pride in it. You know, a group of lions is a pride. Lion is the king of the jungle. Lion is the it's majestic. It's regal. It's the everything that I could think about Lion, and that's why I called it. And the original foundation of Lion Partnership was to actually get a group, a collective, and create a co-op that has all these great vendors and people in this industry will get together and offer an opportunity to make things better. And that's where Lion Partnership got to fruition, and that was in November of 22, and it's just been a wild, wild ride since.
Well, Peter, I want to dive more into that, but before we do, you said you had taken some time off from the car industry.
So
what were you doing
in 2008, I was at a JLR dealership, Jaguar Land Rover dealership, and making an unbelievable amount of money as a salesperson. It was just incredible. But my circle of friendship from that dealership with all my clients and everything else, they didn't understand I was a car salesman. They understood I made a great amount of money and I could afford to go golfing at the best golf courses. And I could afford to go to the restaurants that they went to and the bars and go boating and do all the stuff that they did. But they didn't understand that I couldn't take off a Saturday. I couldn't just leave a Friday afternoon and go golfing or anything like that. So they got banded together, all about a dozen of my clients who were in my closest circle of influence, and said, how do we take Peter out of the car industry? How do we create something? So in 2008, we decided to build a direct mail car magazine. And it was absolutely incredible. The platform we built and the research and everything we did. And we said, we're going to start it. And in October of 2008, I resigned my position. In November of 2008, seven manufacturers went bankrupt. The very first thing that get happened is that your advertising budget gets cut. And so right off the bat, we struggled. So for about a year, I tried to get it put in place, but it was just a failing proposition. And so again, the circle of influence turned around to me and said, well, you're such a great individual in sales. You're not a salesperson. You're a trusted advisor, and we trust you so much. Can you bring that to my business, and can you bring your sales development to my business? I said, sure. So I ended up working in mining, real estate, pharmaceutical, hospitality, automotive, retail, you name it. I was in every vertical. And my last vertical I was in was actually legal, and I was teaching divorce lawyers on how to actually create a sales oriented business. And it was an incredible thing. And I traveled all over North America doing it. It was wild. But again, the car business pulled me back in 2017. I was asked to run a group of Volvo dealerships. That was back into my joy. And I really, really love the business. It's a very unique business. There's nothing like it.
What do you think was at the core of that terrible experience that you had? Was it a lack of training, or what
greed
was the root cause?
It was greed by the dealer. Where I got there was my wife was involved in a small collision, a tiny collision with her tail. It cracked the rear bumper, cracked the taillight, and put a golf ball sized dent in the tailgate. Nothing major. The car went, because the car's taillights were broken, it couldn't be driven. Went to the body shop. It spent 9 months in the body shop. And in that time period, they had to pay for a rental car. Now, a Tesla rental car in Canada is $500 a day.
What?
So $500 a day for the rental car. And then and the body shop is charging $150 a day for storage. And then... at the end of 9 months, because the car was sitting outside and not being plugged in, the suspension collapsed, the tires flat spotted, the brakes seized, battery went, but they just said, write it off. It totaled the car. And because I had replacement value insurance, my entire claim was $325,000 approximately.
Oh my God. Yeah,
for a $2,000 damage.
For a $50,000 car.
So in saying that, I went out and I went to buy a car because the car was written off. I needed a replacement car. We were just coming out of COVID, so the inventory issues were low, and I had to find a car. And I said, well, I don't know what I want to buy. My wife didn't know what she wanted. I said, well, I'm going to buy a car that I know I can get in and get out of it in no time without any pain. So I went in and I bought a Jeep Wrangler. And one of my closest friends was the ex-president of Chrysler, so I had his buying number. I'd worked at this Chrysler dealership as a young man. I knew the dealer principal. I bought 7 vehicles from them. I referred over 250 people to them to buy cars. I knew the current owner of the car dealership. The car was in stock, and I said, there's the car I want. Here's my credit card. All I want to do is pay MSRP. That's it. I'm not even going to use my buying power from my buddy. I said, just sell it to me for MSRP. I know the business right now. Just industry courtesy, do that. Don't charge me any of the back end crap. And it ended up that they charged me about $1,500 over MSRP. And then they tried to keep the government rebate back on the car because it was a plug-in hybrid. And they tried saying it all was built into the price. And we went back and forth, and they eventually rescinded it and gave me my government rebate. But in that point in time, I put in a CSI that I knew, being in the business, that would hit them. And because I knew if I gave them a zero, a flat zero across the board, they get it pulled as a non-score. So they needed a score. So I gave the salesperson the numbers, so the salesperson won't get hit, but I hit the dealership for what they deserved. Well, the GM of the dealership called me up, swearing like a drunken sailor on a Friday night. Unbelievable language. And in that conversation, he turned around and said, where's the industry courtesy? And I said, well, that's funny. You're using the same language that I used when I was in there. And you said you didn't care at that point. Well, now you do. And so he basically asked me if I liked sex and travel and hung up the phone. And at that point in time, I wrote about it and linked it. I had about 15,000 connections in LinkedIn at that point in automotive. And it was picked up by all the trade magazines. And I didn't want to talk about that. I wanted to talk about how we're going to make this industry better. How are we going to take what it should be from where it is? And right now, we know in the industry, it has a 40% trust factor. It has a 70% defection rate. It has over a 70% turnover rate for staff. The average salesperson lasts 1.6 years in a dealership. The average salesperson or sales manager is 3.9 years. The average GM is 7.1 now. It's all going down, down, down. And what dealers are the misconception of dealers is saying, oh, we'll just replace them. They don't factor in low costs. They don't factor in the cost of long-term customer values. They don't look at any of that. And that's the biggest challenge that's going on. I was on a Clubhouse call this morning that it was all about retention of the client. How do we do it organically without asking for the referral, without asking them to come back? How do we get the clients to actually see that we're working for them and we're not working for the dealer? Because it's them who pays us. And once we get there, it's amazing on the transformation of how everything works. It's phenomenal. And that's one of the best things about our industry. If we do our job properly and correctly, we never have to work at it. It just it's flowing. It's like having a great restaurant and the word gets out. You never have to advertise. Tesla doesn't do any advertising. Why is that? Because they do it right in the way they sell cars. And that's what people want.
Do you think that the Tesla model of, you know, I drive a Tesla, so I went through the whole experience of buying one, used the app. The entire experience was like 20 minutes at the dealership, right? They give you the car. Do you think that that model is going to become more widespread in the industry of really having no engagement with a salesperson, or do you think it's sort of an anomaly?
That's a great question. And I'll go back to, I've had 5 Teslas. I'll never buy another one, but I've had 5 of them. And they were a lot better than they are today. But going to the factor of the Tesla model, I remember going to look at a Tesla, and the reason why we went to look at a Tesla is my wife is a tall lady, and her line of sight to see a stoplight when she stopped across the street from a stoplight is very difficult for her in most cars. So jokingly, I said, oh, you got to go look at the Tesla Model X, which has the fighter jet cockpit where there is no header. It's just all glass. And we walked in and we saw the Model S there, and she saw it and she goes, what is that? And I said, she explained it to her. She goes, I want that car right there, right there. Yeah. We couldn't buy that car on the showroom floor, on the service center floor. We had to go home and buy it online. I was floored by that after working in the industry for so long. I'll buy it here. No, you can't do it from one of our IP addresses. You have to go home. So we went home, we bought the car online, came back and picked the car up.
Why is that?
Because it's not part of, they're not dealerships. They're service centers. And that was Tesla's original model. Now you can actually buy them on the floors at the dealership. But the original model didn't allow that because that's how they got away with some of their business licensing around North America. But in retrospect to what is happening in the automobile industry, one of the challenges is dealers say nobody wants to buy a car online. And my argument to that is tell the 7 million people that bought new and used Teslas. They all were bought online, every single one of them.
How about Carvana?
Is another online purchasing. Look at the record profits that they're making. They're $75, $7,800 per unit going out the door buying online. And that's part of the reason, because they don't have salespeople. They don't have this. They don't have that. They're not paying people the exorbitant incomes that salespeople demand to work in the car business. Now, the challenge is the ownerships work off of fear. Their whole thing is the fear of the unknown. What happens if I don't get this lead? What happens if I don't have this? They live in this fear-based world that they're going to fail because the numbers that have been ingrained, if you get X amount of leads, you'll get X amount of contacts. If you get X amount of contacts, you'll get X amount of appointments, you'll get X amount of shows, you'll get X amount of test drives, you'll get X amount of closes. So they see, okay, if I get 1,000 leads, I'm going to get a close. So they just work off a math situation. So they look off of fear. How do you stop that? Well, you turn around and you say, well, if I give them the price online, they're just going to shop me. Well, create a business that no one shops you. Do you think Delta Airlines cares what American Airlines does? No. Do they both give prices online? Absolutely. They're different carriers. They offer different services. They offer different platforms. Yes, they fly from LaGuardia to LAX. Both, but who do you want to fly with? Who has the best service? Who has the best seats? Who has the best on time available? You build that reputation. And that is key to this industry and understanding how to build out your sales force. Now, I tend to look at it and I say, there's two models out there. There's the model that doesn't give any pricing. you're not going to give any pricing. And what's going to happen? People are just going to come in and bounce off your. Then there's the model that gives pricing right off the bat. And I'll say one dealership that does it and does it the best I've ever seen is Sewell Cadillac in Dallas. The only thing you have to give at Sewell Cadillac is your zip code, and they'll give you a penny perfect price all the way down to purchasing your car because they don't care. They know what service they're going to give. They know what they're going to do. They know that people want to buy off Sewell. When NADA was in Dallas, I was there at Sewell Cadillac, and they had a 2.5-year waiting list to buy a Cadillac from them. I said, well, what's the average dealership in Catlin? And they said 6 to 8 months. But people were willing to wait that long just to say that they bought from Sewell because they knew the service that they were going to get from Sewell as a customer. It is so critical that we change the dynamics. When I'm discussing dynamic with stakeholders, I say, here's a simple equation. You fly, right? And they go, oh, yeah, we fly here, there, wherever. I said, okay. So when you go, and typically not the big players that have their own private jets, but the smaller guys, and I say, when you fly, how do you go complain to it? Oh, I just go online. I said, okay. So let me ask you this. If you went online to buy a plane ticket and they turn around and said, hey, that's great. What's your name, number, email address, date of birth, your social insurance or social security number, all this, give me all that before I give you a price. And the price is going to range. But if you want an exact price, come to the airport. And if you come to the airport, we don't know if we have a ticket available for you or a seat or a plane, but come down anyways. But you have to come down right away. Otherwise, you're going to sell your ticket. What would a dealer principal, a sales manager, a general manager, hell, even a lot porter do at that point? They'd go to the next airline. Do it with a restaurant. Do it with a hotel. Do it with anything that we're trained to buy online. Do you think Amazon got as big as they did without giving out prices? They're not the cheapest. They just provide transparency. And that's what the buying public wants. And now if you're not doing that in the car business, you are going in the wrong direction at a high rate of speed.
What are the main objections you hear from leaders in the industry to
showing
pricing?
They're going to go somewhere else. They're going to take my price and go somewhere else. How did CarMax get as big as they did and they give pricing? Did people go somewhere else, or did CarMax create trust that people believed in them and they went from peddlers to salespeople to consultants to trusted advisors? They went up the pyramid because, hey, I can trust CarMax buying my car for what they said it was over Kelley Blue Book, over AccuTrade, over this, because they have a reputation of doing it. And what happens when you go into a car dealership and you say, can you appraise my car? Oh, just go down to CarMax and get a price. It happens 50% of the time. They will tell you to go to CarMax to get the price. They don't want the issue of having to be involved in doing that transaction with a trade. Trades become an issue. That's just another area to lose trust with the customer rather than gain trust. And that's the challenge.
Hey.
Well, CarMax, when they first came out, you know, their whole thing was one price selling, and people flocked to CarMax because they didn't like the games that were played at the dealerships. People don't like that negotiation process, the back and forth to the sales tower. And people will pay for that. CarMax demonstrated that. And then Carvana followed it up. I think it was John Krafcik, the former head CEO of Hyundai North America, said that people would rather visit a dentist and get a root canal than they go.
Well, what is the average time it takes to purchase a car in the United States?
Over 3 hours.
Four and a half hours.
Wow.
Is the average time to purchase a car. And here, there's another stat out there what's the average amount of dealerships a person will visit before purchasing a car?
1.5.
Nope.
I'm going to say 6.
Closer to 1. What? Now about 1.4 or 1.6. So you're around.
So they're not bouncing around.
Why is
that anymore?
Because they've done 17 hours online. Of research online before they will ever visit a dealership. Now, why is it 1.4, 1.5, 1.6, whatever it is? It's under 2. Why is that? It's because the first dealership screws up so bad that they have to go to a second dealership. They've already made the decision to purchase at that dealership that they show up at. There is no such thing as shopping for a car anymore. People go to a dealership once they've made the decision. They're not going there because the first dealership they go to is not the highest priced dealership. They're going there because it's the lowest priced dealership. So there is no reason to negotiate. Therefore, the one price model actually works. But what really works in this business is the one person model. The one person model is going to take over the industry. Now that means no desking manager, no F&I manager. They're going to be eliminated from the business. And every dealer that I talk to goes, what are you talking about? You're crazy. You have no idea what you're talking about. I said, well, I've been doing this for over 40 years and we did it that way over 40 years ago. And we retained our customers and we had our car people and we had our professionals and you looked up to those people as professionals, not as it changed with technology. Well, technology has made a reverse and now you have companies like A to Z Sync, Upstart, AutoFI, they're all coming back to one price model. So the person does not have to leave the salesperson to go to the next stage. And that's where the individual enjoys it because they don't feel every time a person, if I'm sitting here and I got up from my chair and walked away, what do you think? There's two things. One, they're trying to figure out on how to charge me more. Or two, the person isn't competent to make that decision. And that leads to number three is distrust. So all these dealerships that are going into this are seeing, yes, their GP might drop ever so slightly, but they're making it up in labor cost and then some. So their NP becomes much higher than their GP. So their ratio goes up and that's going to change. And because we're entering into a technological revolution that has never happened in the car business. So we went through a revolution. Then we went through a financial revolution with buyback pricing and then we had through leasing and we had all kinds of different avenues and then tax rebates and things like that that changed the dynamics on how we sold cars. But today with AI and with social media and dynamic websites and dynamic pricing and everything else, it's changing so rapidly that the dinosaurs, and I had this conversation with David Spizak in Chicago just a little while ago, and I said, the problem with the car industry is the meteor has hit the earth. The dinosaurs just don't know yet. And they're still remaining in the past. They don't understand the power of social media. They don't understand that an individual carry around a cell phone has more computing power than what took to put man on the moon. And they just don't get it that instantaneous conversation can happen. And I can sit across from you two here right now, get on my cell phone and get 15 quotes on a car as I'm talking to you. And why do I need to do that? I don't if you're doing the right job. And that's the big thing. If we do the right job, no one's ever going to interrupt the process. Never.
I get the feeling that trust is at the cornerstone of these good experiences and building a successful dealership. What are some other ways that trust can be created? I mean, transparency is one of them. I get that.
Trust is consistency, transparency, integrity, have a process in place. If you don't have, I'm hooked up with one company and we design processes for dealerships from the interview stage right to termination stage, every process in between, every single situation. I was trained in ISO 9002, which in the car business is about 22 4-inch thick binders on how to sell a car. You have to read them all. It's like reading War and Peace daily for 3 years before you actually get certified. It's awesome. But when you get through it, you understand process and you can actually answer all questions out there. So the transparency, the consistency, the professionalism, the dedication, the everything shows through when you're talking to your customer. You become a professional. You become at the level, and this is something that most people don't get, what a subject matter expert is. A subject matter expert is someone who has 10,000 hours at doing the same thing. If that's a doctor, that's a lawyer. Well, most salespeople are subject matter experts after 10 years of being in the business. You would get your PhD in automobile sales at 10 years. Well, I've got 4 PhDs in this business and understanding it from 4 different pillars of this business, OEM, dealer, vendor, and self-employed. So it's that the whole percentage is understanding, and David Long says it best. There's 2 dealerships. There's the dealership that you think you run and the dealership that you run. And the only way you can get to the dealership you run is actually, and forget about 20 groups, forget about all these different platforms. You want to know how you're running your dealership? Get 20 of your customers that bought and didn't buy into a meeting room. Give them $500 worth of incentive to be there. Have someone outside your dealership actually ask the questions and find out where the problems are. Find out where you're doing great things. It's the best game film that you'll ever get. You will get the truth. And so many people have turned around and said, start looking at your dealership from the customer's eyes. Chris, you've got an amazing opportunity with Reputation Sensei that is going to do that. You're actually getting what the dealership should know because it's what the customers are saying. Whether it's good, bad, or indifferent, you know what your customers are actually talking about. And it should be celebrated because that is what's going to make the difference in your business moving forward. I don't care what a KPI is. Ed Roberts at Bozard 4 says, I don't measure KPIs. They're there. I don't measure them against what we do because it's what our customers say and do and react to is what the true measurement of our business is. And then we can only do that if we serve them. When we serve them, we will get the actual truth back to us and we will be able to pivot to make their experience with us a beneficial.
Wow. Interesting. How many dealers do go to the extent that you just talked about and do an actual study?
I've only heard of customers. 2. There's 17,088 franchises in the United States. So I've only heard.
Wow. I mean, big companies do it all the time,
they do
right?
Do those studies all the time. But why wouldn't you, like, when you talk the cost, average cost of acquisition of a new customer is X. Why wouldn't you invest that into 20 and give them something? Not only that, so you get 10 customers and 10 non-customers. The 10 customers, you give them $500 of service work. Hey, we're going to detail your car. We'll do this. We'll do that. What's that cost to you? $150, whatever. It doesn't matter. The other people, what's your cost of acquisition? And if you show them that you're so interested in what they have to say, what's the opportunities that they're going to come back next, or they're going to refer someone to you, and how many referrals you're going to get from them. They were so concerned about why I didn't buy the car. They invited me back in, and they gave me a weekend away in the local city, Oakdale, and a weekend away with the kids or whatever. You got kids? Great. We'll send you to Disney World for the day. You got this? We'll send you here. We'll figure out something that is important to you, and we'll do it for you because you matter to us. And that's what the issue from transactional sales to relational sales is. Carl Sewell believes that every single customer is worth 30 comps. 30. He's built an empire on that. Now, if we look at what happened is we're so quick to race to the bottom to get every single deal because we're looking for the back end money. We're looking for the volume incentive bonuses. We're looking for the CSI bonuses. We're looking for this. And that's what we're looking for. We're racing to the bottom and we don't care how many transactions, if it's in our area or out of our area. And that's where you get, and nothing against them. You get companies like Dan Cummings, where when Lindy came from, doing 800, 900 feet car sales in a town of 7,000 people per month. So you're not selling in your AOR. You're selling outside your AOR. What's the opportunity that they're going to come back in service with you? What's your longevity plan with them? There is no longevity plan. All it is a churn. It's not a retention plan. And that, to me, is, in my humble opinion, is not going to create growth with the dealership. Because eventually, you're just working on the gymship membership model, and it's a churn. We just have to keep building
them. Do you think this changed how dealerships should think about the skill sets
Absolutely.
And the people they're hiring? Different.
Absolutely. So the skill set of the person that you're hiring, first of all, should be hospitality based. Everything else can be trade. They have to have a mindset hospitality. We are in a hospitality business selling a commodity. That's all we're doing. We want to retain those customers. I did a math equation because dealers look at, and we mentioned earlier, the sales funnel. Fill up the funnel. Just keep the funnel filled and we'll get X amount of opportunity. If you look at the actual conversion ratios, a person who is a repeat customer will convert at 80 to 90%. A referral convert at 70 to 80%. 60%. A walk-in will convert at 25%. A internet lead will convert at 10%. And a telephone lead will convert at 5%. Yet dealers focus on the last three. They focus on the last three, hoping to get them to the appointment stage. Now, they worked and they paid for the acquisition cost of all these first-party customers that are in their system, and they do not work the referral and the repeat business, which is the highest converting number. If you are a salesperson today, and this is the importance of reputation and doing the job right, if you turn around and you said to each one of your comps, and right now the number of sales in the United States is 10 units per salesperson per month, so 120 cars a year. If you got one organic referral because of your reputation, and I'm not, when I say reputation, I'm not saying ask for referrals. I never did it in my career, and I will never do it. If you do it organically, get one referral, a 10-car-a-month salesperson will be a 45-car-a-month salesperson in 3.5 years. Just by reputation, just by referral. That's not counting any repeat business. That's just reputation referrals. And that is so significant that people don't understand how it is. I spent 45 minutes on a call this morning specifically on reputation referrals. And when you do the math, it's your quickest way to double, triple, quadruple your income.
What percentage of salespeople are taking advantage of that
strategy? Less than 5%
in the industry, would you say?
Less than 5%. And the reason why that is because in the model of the U.S. right now, it's posted everywhere. And I looked at a big dealer group the other day, and they had their sales board. When I talk about their sales board, it's their sales activity board, not their sales completion board. It's the activity board. They mandate their salespeople do 50 phone calls a day, 20 emails, 20 text messages, 10 videos, and 2 appointments. Create 2 appointments. That's their positioning. That's a salesperson. Now, let's just look at how backwards that is. You have about 160 working hours in a month. Okay. It takes 4 hours to sell a car. You're asked to sell 15 cars a month to be out of the danger zone in a car dealership. So at that point, you're 60 hours. That leaves you 100 hours left. Now, of the 100 hours left, if you convert 1 in 3, you are at negative 20. You're at negative 20. You don't even have enough time to make phone calls, emails, this, that, whatever, to maximize that opportunity. So either you're lacking in the relational sale when the person's in the dealership, and you don't care enough to be with them because they do not, you have to convert all these 50 phone calls a day. You have and if you look at it the other way, you have less than a minute on most case scenarios to make a phone call. Am I going to establish a relationship with you? Hey, Chris, you know what? I'm calling you about the F-150 that you were in the other day. And unfortunately, that one was sold, but I got another one coming in. Would you like to put your name on it? No? Okay, great. Thanks. Bye. Yeah. What reputation are you building with your customer? You are becoming a peddler. You are not a trusted advisor at that point. In Canada, we have 2.5 times the franchises per capita. So in the United States, you have 17,000 franchises. We should have 1,700 franchises in Canada. We have 4,700 franchises in Canada. So we're 2.5 times. The average car salesman in Canada sells 12 cars a month. So 20% more than the U.S. Now, if I ask the per salesperson in Canada to make phone calls, they'd laugh at me. They would say, no, I'm a self-employed individual. I work the way I work. And they walk out, and you wouldn't retain any staff. What happens in Canada, we work on a relational sale business where we want to create a relationship with the customer, and they are the priority. And when we make them our priority, we actually have a higher conversion ratio. And that's how we sell more cars than U.S. We have a third of the salespeople. Like, there's no dealership in Canada that has 50 or 60 salespeople like a Longo Toyota, or even though they sell a similar amount based on population.
I can imagine the pushback you must get when you come into a dealership and you're saying, we don't need to make all these calls.
Oh,
you're doing forever. You're telling them they're going to get better results and more efficiency.
Activity does not breed success. Quality breeds success. If you create from quantity, remove the quantity. Some dealerships can work like that. Yeah, sure, go ahead, work like that. But if you actually build quality into the call, hey, Chris, you know what? I remember you coming in last week on that F-150, you know, we went through things and we did this and we did that. There's a couple of new trucks that have arrived. I went through them. These are the options with them. one's a little bit different. One's this, one's that. The finance price is going to be varying about $4 or $5 based on the truck you choose. I know towing was important to you, and this one has a towing set up already for it. And actually have that quality conversation with someone, you're going to build that trust and respect from the customer that why would I go to another dealership? Hey, you're looking for me. You're looking out for me. Like, you don't go, when you go buy a house, do you go from real estate agent to real estate agent to real estate agent to get a house? No. You stay with the one that you trust and respect, and that respects you and understands you. And that's the biggest fallout I see in this business. We don't look at it that way. We look at, hey, you know what? I'm just going to keep going. And customers don't want to go to dealerships. As you said, they'd rather have a root canal. I don't want to go and start at square one again with someone that I don't know. That I haven't built up that trust and rapport. No. And it's like, when I ran Volvo dealerships, I said to the sales staff at my Volvo dealerships, I said, think about this. Why are they here? Nobody comes to a Volvo dealership just to look at a Volvo. There's not a person on this planet that goes to a Volvo dealership just to look at a Volvo. They come for one reason.
It is
safety. And to reaffirm their initial experience that the safety is what a Volvo is all about. You don't talk about anything else. The PEL pin for a Volvo is a safety pin. That's what Volvo is all about. You don't have to talk about performance. You just have to reaffirm their decision-making process that this was the right car for them.
They probably don't want they don't want performance. They want just, this to be right. Give me like a slow
exactly.
And
it's like people go to Tesla because of technology. They go to Mercedes because the star notch. You have to understand what the branding is, and then play to that branding. All you're doing is reaffirming the brand, i.e., the reputation of the brand, and then you are turning around. Reaffirming their decision. That's it. It's not hard. It's not rocket science.
Yeah.
And if you give them that integrity and trust and respect, there's no reason for someone to go somewhere. You just have to be professional about it. And that's the problem, because we sit there and we fill the seat with someone who can fog a mirror, because that's what we need. We have these recruiting fairs that we have 10, 15 people show up to go work in the dealership. We'll pick 5 of them, and then in 1 month's time, 4 of the 5 of them are gone. We need another recruiting fair when we're just not doing the job properly. No one accepts that, because the egos of this business are huge, and we know that because what's on the side of the building? So-and-so's Nissan, so-and-so's Cadillac, so-and-so's BMW.
Right.
It's rarely the town. It's rarely the area. It's always this name or that name, and it's always someone's name. And it's the ego. Otherwise, it wouldn't happen. I built it. And we hear it inside out as well when we talk to the stakeholders. They say, I do it this way. I built this business. It's my name on the building. I've served that 40 years straight. It's my name on the building. And they're not talking about it in reputation. They're talking about it in process.
Do you think there's going to be a shift back toward more training in the automotive industry? Because, you know, after COVID, the sales skills have greatly been diminished over the past 4 years. And one of the discovery questions that we ask is, where would you rate your team's execution of customer experience on a scale of 1 to 5? And we're hearing more 3s and 4s today than we've ever heard before.
I wouldn't give it that. I'd say 1s, 2s, and 3s over 3s and 4s. You want to know what your reputation is, your true reputation? Go on Indeed. Want to look at what your score is? Look at Indeed. And there's so many dealerships out there that got 2.1 stars, 2.2 stars, 2.5 stars, 2.6 stars. That's 52%. That's the people who want to work for you. that tells you exactly where you stand.
So you're saying that it all begins with...
Yes, absolutely. It's 100% internally. Richard Branson said it best, treat your team better than your customers as they will treat your customers the right way. If you want to have people working for you that want to remain, earlier, it's 1.6, 1.7 years is the average tenure in sales for a dealership. Wow. That means if we went back 3 terms, we would just hit prior to COVID. That's how bad the turnover is in a dealership. And the turnover in the dealership directly reflects on how the customer is being looked after, because those people are taking either habits learned somewhere else, or they're not establishing proper habits to remain. So training is one concept. Coaching is the next. Training attributes to 23% lift in performance. When you combine it with coaching, it elevates it to 88% lift in performance. You need coaching more than you need training. And coaching is basically reviewing the game film all the time. How did we do on this one? Did we win? Great. How did we win? We lose, and going through that and understanding how to dynamically change that and build out better. And that is, again, going back to your customers, understanding what your customers are saying. What is your reputation out there? What is your true reputation? There's companies out there, and I know of one, that I can go in right now and I can go through 17,000 dealerships and know exactly what people say about them. Exactly. And that's every dealership. Wow. How long it takes for them to respond to a complaint, and their entire reputation. I know. And dealers, no one looks. Yeah? Well, if no one looks at that, why are companies established to be?
When you work with a dealership, are you working with the leadership of the dealership,
or
are you
working directly with the company? I do a number of different things. One is I operate a media opportunity with Clubhouse Rooms, podcasts, and LinkedIn Lives. I also operate as a strategic advisor to dealerships, and depending on where the dealership needs it, depends on where I go in. I have over 20 different verticals just for involvement in a dealership. So it could be a mystery shop. It could be succession planning. It could be process design. It could be onboarding. You name it. There's so many different things that I can involve in. Now, I'm not an expert on everything. I'll never profess to be one. That's where the partnership comes in. I've established over the last 2.5 years so many people out there that are trusted advisors that I can say, hey, here's the person that is going to build a BDC. Here's the person that's going to train your BDC. So I have 4 or 5 different verticals in BDC. I have X amount of verticals in HR through onboarding, recruitment, this, that. So I have built all those partnerships that can do it. So I'm open to everything with that. And then the last part of my company is where I turn around and create awareness for great companies that are out there that fall into that vertical that could be a partner with Line Partnership, that I'll go out there and I'll build their awareness to the industry, because they're up and coming. They've started. They're just startups. They've hit the ceiling of 50 dealerships, and to grow to the next level, they got to get 250 or whatever. Well, how do they do that? They need the awareness to get out there. So that's essentially how I go through it. But when to answer your question, more often than not, it's the ownership of the dealership that actually contacts me, because they're the ones that turn around and they say, well, my GM's not doing his job. Well, your GM might be doing their job. It could be what you're asking them to do. And that's just not acceptable. And they need to know that as well.
That's interesting. So I guess switching topics a little bit, what do you think the role of social media is for dealerships now?
Absolutely massive. And there's there's two social medias. I call it business media and social media. Business media is LinkedIn and a number of different platforms out there that is relatively internalized within the industry. And then there's social media, which is your YouTube, your TikToks, your Instagram, your Facebook, and all the other consumer socials. And they're both equally important. They're really equally important. They should be actively pursued on both levels. Now, as a salesperson, the greatest one that is overlooked is LinkedIn. As a dealership, the greatest one that's overlooked is Facebook. And most of the dealer principals out there are silver hairs like me, and they grew up after the social media revolution. The internet came out while they were selling cars. They weren't born into the internet. It was after the fact. It's like when I've been at certain meetings and I'm with a person of the younger generation and I'm sitting at the table with them, they got their laptop open and they're transcribing the meeting as we're talking. And it just blows me away. And I'm going, well, and this one's before Otter and all the other AIs that came out that just record them now, but they're sitting there and they're just tapping away on their keyboard as I'm talking away. And then when I stop talking, they stop taping.
Court reporter.
And thinking, okay, they go to university and they're sitting there in their university class and they're transcribing their university class. They're doing this, they're doing that. And it's a totally foreign affair to us that are at a leadership level.
And
because we never grew up in that. It's those who can adapt will succeed. And that's right through technology. That's right through social media. That's right through everything. And that's why I said the dinosaurs are caught in the glacier right now. They're caught with glacier ice and they don't know that they're moving towards the tar pits. And they don't realize that they can actually still get out and survive, but they're not doing it. And that's the biggest challenge that we face. How many people have this tattoo on their arm? We've always done it this way. You send your teams to training. You spend tens of thousands of dollars in training. And when they get back, they say, what'd you learn? Oh, that's great. Well, we're going to do it this way. They don't look outside the box. I was always successful because I knew that the only way to grow was to be outside the box. You can't grow in the box. You die in the box. So that's the main challenge that we have to get through to the stakeholders right now.
Makes sense. Chris, you want to take us home?
One question, a couple of questions. Like, who's some of your inspirations? Who do you look for mentorship or
you a reader? Yeah, absolutely. So I'm a voracious reader. I love reading. One of the conversations that was made the other day was if you look at the average CEO of a multinational, they read over 50 nonfiction books a year, one a week. Most people go, how do you do that? Well, the average nonfiction book is about 120 pages. And in doing so, it's 15, 20 pages a day. That's it. And to go through that, to read, you're probably looking at half an hour, 45 minutes a day to read. And you will gain so much knowledge. Now, you can go even one step further. You can go to Blinkist and read a book in 15 minutes. They will actually take out all the key takeaways, and you listen to the takeaways, and you're done.
Blinkist.
So you can actually get everything into your knowledge base. But if you want my absolute favorite author, Tom Clancy.
I got to challenge you on that. Frankie would take three chapters to describe one scene. Yeah, so.
Born Identity.
Yes.
Hunt for Red October. And then the other one, which is your favorite. So, Clyde Cussler. All those three authors I love.
Most recent favorite nonfiction book you've read.
Best nonfiction book in the last little while is the one by Jocko Willbeck. Extreme Ownership.
Extreme Ownership.
Yeah. And it's so true. When you look at it and how they operate as SEALs and who takes, who really is accountable for it. And a good friend once said to me, the fish stinks from the head down. And that's exactly what extreme ownership's all about. The top is where anybody should take accountability. And that is one of the most brilliant things that has ever come across me, is that you...
His attitude is awesome, because whatever problem is thrown at him, his automatic response is...
Absolutely. Yeah. And you know what? We can't move forward until we solve things. So whatever throws in front of you, and the fear of failure should not be a fear. It's just another opportunity to get by. And that's something that if I looked at and we were talking about sports analogies, the very best batter in baseball hit 402. I mean, 6 out of 10 times they failed. That's the best.
Yeah.
6 out of 10 they failed.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think Ted Williams ever would go to the plate saying, I'm going to fail more times than I'm going to win? No, he said, I'm going to hit 4 out of 10 of these, and that's my goal. 4 out of 10. If I hit 4 out of 10, I'm a superstar. In the card business, if I can close 1 in 8, I'm a superstar. You just have to have that positive mindset right off the bat. Me, it was my accident. My accident caused me to have a positive mindset every single day, because I'm on the right side of the dirt. So no matter what is thrown at me, I couldn't care less. You can do anything to me, and I'm going to go, so be it. Let's move on.
Last question we have for you, Peter, is what do you want to be known for?
What I want to be known for is actually just being an all-around good person. That's it. I don't need anything else. I've accomplished a lot in my life. I've enjoyed the fruits of my labor. In 2014, I was asked to write the obituary for my father, for my family. So I was the reader. I was the writer. I wrote what my father had accomplished in his life. And my father was a successful man, but in the material side of things, I was more successful than he was. And I look to what a person he was, and I truly understood servant leadership at that point. And that changed the dynamics of my whole mindset by writing that obituary. And it changed the way I look at things. It changed the way I engage with people, how I will help people first before asking for anything. I'm there to help people. And that's what makes this world great. The people that are there to actually better this planet. And with that, that's what I want to be known for. I just want to be known that I'm there to help.
That's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Peter, thank you so much for your time.
How do people get a hold of you or get in touch with you if they want to reach out?
The easiest way to get a hold of me, one is peter@lionpartnership.com. Or they can call me on my cell, 905-466-2786. Or the best way to find me and the easiest way to find me is on LinkedIn. And you'll find me pretty much anywhere in automotive, talking about something, reposting someone's post. You'll find me there. I'll be tagged by someone.
We'll make sure to put the LinkedIn link to your profile in the show notes. Yeah, so, absolutely. Yeah, well, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I do have one question for you guys. You guys are all going to be at NADA?
January
23rd to 26th, I believe.
Excellent.
Well, I look forward to meeting you there in person. And I thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Reputation Sensei Playbook. Every episode is designed to help you build trust, attract customers, and grow your dealership. Want to see real results? Head to ReputationSensei.com and schedule your free strategy session. Our managed service and Sensei Testimonial app are ready to boost your reputation to new heights. If you found this episode valuable, spread the word to your network. Your success is our success. And remember, in the world of automotive sales, your reputation isn't just part of your business, it is your business. We'll see you on the next episode.